So I was asked to give a talk on cryptographic APIs. Now that's kind of a broad topic. It's kind of, the question is this a research topic or is this a topic that is something that really kind of is more of an engineering topic that faces us today? And so I'm gonna try to answer that question. I'm gonna also try to give some examples of kind of why this is something researchers should be concerning themselves with. But let me give you a quick overview of this session, which I hope will be pretty interactive. So the first question I want to ask is, you know, is there even a research problem here? Is there a problem at all? Is there anything wrong with our existing cryptographic APIs, and is it a security problem we should care about? The next question is, you know, kind of, let's assume that there is, what can we possibly do about it? Is this something that's within our means to deal with? And kind of as researchers, how can we address this problem and the problem that we hope we have? So let me give you a quick motivation for why this is something that's worth talking about today. Okay, so cryptographic software is not a new thing. It's kind of, you know, been out there at least in the open source world since the 70s and the 80s, and the early versions of cryptographic software, of course, we're familiar with things like PGP, open source cryptographic libraries, and OpenSSL. So we have a lot of examples. The thing that's kind of changing, though, is historically as recent as just a few years ago, cryptography was something that was practiced mostly in the context of software that was used for security reasons. So if you were writing crypto software, you were writing software that was ultimately going to be used by people who were kind of in the market to encrypt things and to communicate privately. What that meant is that, you know, a lot of the time the APIs and the software that was being developed was kind of aimed at a very specific kind of expert user. It was not aimed at the general population. And this applied to both to the software itself, but also to the underlying libraries. So the interfaces were not really designed to be easy to use. What's kind of changing in the present day, though, is that cryptography, the use of cryptography is scaling to a lot of applications that you would not traditionally think of as security applications. Nowadays, it's very common for, you know, your note-taking application to include some kind of secure encryption option. Even applications that have really no security purpose still use SSL, and that means that they often make kind of trivial mistakes that lead to the entire application being insecure. And unfortunately, this is likely to get a lot worse in the coming years, partly due to a set of very available APIs, one of them being the W3C Web Crypto API. How many people here have heard of this thing? That's, oh my God, okay, that's a lot of people. So it looks like crypto is kind of coming to the masses if it hasn't already come. And we're going to see what that means for security in general. Just to give you a few kind of ideas of what's going on right now, in case you haven't seen a few of these stories or tweets, people just kind of use cryptography. It's kind of a, you know, you only live once kind of situation in many cases. People using, you know, 64-bit RC2 encryption, people using unauthenticated encryption in major security standards, for example, ASP.NET, the XML security standards, we're using CVC mode encryption. Very, very common problem nowadays is that people are kind of learning on the job how to do password security correctly, and I'm not going to go into that because we already had a talk, but a lot of people kind of discovering SALT for the first time in major production applications. This is the kind of thing that you see a lot, and this is, you know, not something that is limited to amateurs learning how to code. You see people posting to Stack Overflow saying, by the way, I'm encrypting something, and I kind of want to know, do I need an initialization vector? And you're like, okay, some guy's just learning how to code. And then you realize that he's developing, you know, a major Bitcoin wallet for something that's actually being deployed. So that kind of stuff is happening too. So the not very surprising thesis of at least this presentation, my presentation, maybe you guys will disagree, is that this is our fault. That we as the security community, and particularly the cryptographic community, are kind of blowing it. And what I mean by that is that we have kind of decided that this is not our problem. There is a community of engineers whose job it is to build these tools. We should not care too much about it. We should be out there doing research, focusing on how to build, you know, new crypto systems, which is a big focus. In fact, in the crypto community, there's almost a feeling that cryptography is, you know, as Kenny Patterson says, kind of a branch of theoretical computer science, and we should be focusing on theory problems, maybe even more than these kind of mundane practical problems. And I think that this is hurting our entire field, it's hurting our community. Unfortunately, I don't think that education, getting, you know, people together and teaching them how to use IVs is the fix for this. The fix is we actually need tools and techniques that are kind of user resilient. So the reason that I'm focusing specifically on cryptographic APIs is that for most developers, these are the primary API, the primary place where you interact with crypto. You're going to be dealing with this. These are the things that have to kind of keep you on the straight and narrow, and these are the places we can avoid these mistakes before they get into production. So quickly, I just want to kind of kind of want to kind of clarify what I mean by cryptographic APIs. Now, there are a couple of different things that we refer to as cryptographic APIs. What I'm mostly going to be focusing on in this talk is the kind of the first kind, the developer APIs. What people who are honest, good people who, you know, want to interact with your software correctly are going to be using. They're not trying to break your system. They just don't know how to use your system. And that's really the focus of this talk. The second kind of API, which I'm only going to talk about briefly, are these kind of secure APIs. For example, the APIs to hardware security modules and PKCS11 tokens, where what's actually happening now is you have an adversary who's going to be working with your API, and you need to make sure that your API can be tolerant, essentially, in the face of that adversary. There's one or two slides at the end of this, but that's not really the focus. So a big section of this talk is kind of terrible things that happen in crypto. And I'm sorry, this is not a research thing, but I thought it would be fun to kind of convince you guys that there's a problem here. There are many different problems. I'll skip past. So this is the typical developer's interaction with a cryptographic API. I assume you guys know what this is. Anybody use this particular piece of software, recognize it? Text is small, yeah. So this is OpenSSL. This is the most widely used cryptographic library on the planet, really. It's actually an SSL library that just by a kind of set of coincidences happens to expose a series of cryptographic routines that were very convenient for people to use. So a lot of people use OpenSSL. It's not designed to be easy to use. I think the people who develop OpenSSL would like people to stop using it, but unfortunately we still use it. It's not easy. So there's a lot of complexity and there are a lot of ways to get things wrong. This is kind of your laundry list of how you can use OpenSSL wrong. Of course, now I lose my screen connection. Give me a sec. There are a whole bunch of different ways to use OpenSSL wrong. This slide kind of gives you the very short, you know, here's how you encrypt things incorrectly. You can, if you're using counter mode encryption, you have to make sure you call this particular routine at the right time. You have to, under no circumstances, be tempted to get the IV anywhere from other than rand bytes on the encryption side. Don't set it to a fixed value and so on. And you have to make sure that you never overflow a counter and so on. So this kind of stuff is stuff you have to be aware of. Now the problem here is that most people aren't aware of this. This is a particular fix that went into an open source project called SaltStack recently. Does anybody see the problem? Maybe you can't see from back there. So this is the line that was taken away. This is RSA generate key. You're allowed to specify, because it's an OpenSSL interface, you're allowed to specify the public exponent. What better public exponent than one? I mean, one is small, it's very efficient. So the original version said one, and then very quietly they replaced this with the, you know, standard 2^16+1. The best part about this particular bug, which is unrelated, is the comment that appeared below it, which said, just to clarify, this is about the public exponent, not key size. It's of course questionable whether one, not a prime, was a good choice for the exponent to begin with. But it's hardly necessary to lose faith over this. Okay, so I'm picking on people a little bit, but this is the kind of thing that happens. This is not an isolated mistake. It happens in production software as well. Because it happens far too often for us to educate every developer. What's that? Why would there be a choice where you could have, you know, a very common, where you wouldn't have a choice of several secure options rather than one that might not be secure? Now, I can see a case for having some kind of advanced API for those very, very small number of cases where you really need to set a custom exponent. But why should you have an RSA key generation that lets you set one and doesn't fail in an error? So it seems like that's just not a very intuitive API. Now, obviously, somebody made a very stupid mistake, but these kind of mistakes are just far too easy to make. Another problem that we encounter a lot is that the traditional design of a crypto API, which goes back to the, you know, 70s and 80s, is that we are expected as developers to choose the algorithms that we're going to use. They're not going to be picked for us. So for example, very, very common, unfortunately, even in modern software, to see people using unauthenticated CBC encounter mode. Obviously, as researchers, we scoff at this. We know that this is not a problem. This is something we dealt with years ago. We are not going to, you know, lower ourselves to go back and convince people not to do this. And yet it's happening in software that's coming out today. Why are people doing this? Well, we're giving people the choice of these algorithms rather than composed algorithms that add authenticity and do it efficiently. Someone going to say something? Okay. One of the things that we allow people to do, and unfortunately almost encourage people to do in the TLS world, is use RC4 with all of its kind of attendant problems. We don't help people generically compose for example, ciphers and different MACs. This is a big problem. We expect people to do it, which has led to all kinds of problems. Even in TLS, we're doing the encrypt and MAC backwards. And there's a huge emphasis. When you say to people, why don't you just make this easy? Why don't you just give people default options? The first thing they say is, we have to support legacy applications. And that's true. There are a few places where you have to support legacy crypto, but you don't have to support it everywhere. A very big example of this, and I'm going to come back to why I'm picking on this one in particular, is the RSA PKCS1 v1.5 algorithm. This is just the worst. I mean, you don't even want to say RSA PKCS v1.5. This is a padding scheme for RSA. How many people are familiar with this? Okay, so RSA PKCS v1.5, the problem with it is what? Exactly. There's an attack by Daniel Bleichenbacher that completely defeats the security of this, allows you to decrypt ciphertext with access to a decryption oracle that just gives you whether there was an error or not. Very hard to get this right. In fact, we don't even know, we know how to make it. We just found out recently how to build secure protocols using PKCS1 v1.5. But it's very hard to do it right. Even OpenSSL today has a current timing vulnerability that allows you to essentially attack the OpenSSL handshake in the current version. So it's very hard for us. What's that?
Should be fixed if Ben is unattached.
Is it in?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, anyway, the timing vulnerability may be fixed, but there are kind of current problems. So there are a lot of kind of this use and almost recommendation of obsolete algorithms. We allow people to select them. This is something that we need to move away from. I'll move more quickly because I'm covering a lot of known stuff here, but there are some very fun things. Has anybody ever dealt with the, this is the Java standard library. This is the javax.crypto. There is a javax.crypto.cipher interface that allows you to do symmetric encryption with a block cipher. Now, the way you're supposed to use this is you're supposed to specify the algorithm slash the mode of operation that you're going to use slash the padding scheme. But you don't have to. You could just give the algorithm. You could say, I want to encrypt with AES. And do you know what's going to happen when you say that? It's going to choose for you what mode of operation you're going to get and what padding scheme you're going to get. And it may be different across implementations. Now, nobody would do this in production software. Nobody would say, I want to encrypt with AES, right? Nobody would do that. So this is a code search that shows several active projects, VFS and the libjboss web services, are basically just saying to the Java crypto stuff, hey, I want to use AES. Who knows what they're getting? They could be getting ECB mode. They could be getting improper padding. So this is a problem there. We have to make sure that people can't use insecure combinations. Big problem, which probably was already talked about today, was the certificate chain validation. Okay, this is the Microsoft crypto API, so I want to spread my criticism around a little. This is Microsoft's crypto API and their certificate chain validation function. So far, it doesn't look so complicated. I mean, it does look complicated, but it's not that bad. So what am I complaining about here? Well, the return value from this function, let me read this to you. The return value indicates whether the function was able to check for the policy. It does not indicate whether the policy check failed or passed. Now, these are kind of just, you know, rookie mistakes, but this is an active API that people are using. So this is very non-intuitive. How do we get people to, you know, go on and check for these internal things? This was a paper that was by Dan Bonet and a number of people from Stanford, where they basically went through and they looked for other certificate validation errors. I'm highlighting this one. This is curl, C-U-R-L, which actually has a really nice, what they call an interface that is almost perversely bad. Okay, so the curl opt SSL verify host option takes 1 to check the existence of a common name in the SSL, 2 to check the existence of a common name and also verify that it matches the host name provided. In production environments, the value of this option should be kept at 2. What that means is if you get confused and you pass in a Boolean true instead of a 2, you will be validating the certificate chain. But you will not be validating that the certificate chain actually matches the server you're talking to. So there are a lot of different ways to misuse things. I'm just pointing this one out because it's my favorite. This is OpenSSL's random function. Rand bytes returns 1 on success, 0 otherwise. You can actually call a rand pseudo bytes. This is not really an API problem. I just really like looking at the code of OpenSSL. You can pass, basically you will call rand pseudo bytes and you'll only get pseudo non-cryptographically secure pseudo random bytes. The only reason I'm picking on this one is because I really like the way it's implemented. If you look inside of this particular chunk of code, what you will find out is that both rand bytes and rand pseudo bytes go to exactly the same routine. If something goes wrong, if not OK, and it's a pseudo random call, then you return 0. If it's something goes wrong and you're calling the secure, cryptographically secure random number generator, you return it, you put an error into the stack that says, you need to read the OpenSSL frequently asked questions. This is the only difference between these two calls. That's not a problem, but it's also kind of ridiculous. So why are people doing this kind of stuff? Last kind of non-intuitive thing, this one is also great. OpenSSL BNRAN generates a cryptographically strong pseudo-random number of bits, bits in length, and stores it in RAND. If top is -1, the most significant bit of the random number can be 0. If top is 0, it is set to 1. And if top is 1, the two most significant bits will both be set to 1. Does this make any sense to anybody here? I mean, this is the kind of thing that people have to use. So anyway, I'm just picking on OpenSSL now. It's not exactly fair. The last thing that I want to pick on in terms of non-intuitive interfaces is the bcrypt library that's actually built into PHP, which, by the way, is one of the most popular implementations for password hashing. It says that you can pass a 2-digit input indicating the strength of the password. Okay, so that's basically a number from 0 to 99? No. Because if you pass in any number less than 10, it will fail. What it means is the number has to be passed in as a string that is two digits long. And so the person who was writing to this, the person who complained about this, said, I understand how you were confused about this, but if you read carefully, it does say that the cost parameter is 2 digits. Using 2 digits works correctly for 04 to 31. Okay, so this stuff is not that important. But maybe we have some more serious problems, one of which is that a lot of the time we have APIs that try to deal with binary data in kind of insecure ways. So many of these scripting languages, maybe changing with Python 3, for example, don't differentiate well between strings and binary blobs. So you can end up with situations where what you think you have is, you know, either a binary blob or maybe it's just a piece of hex, but you don't quite know how it's going to be interpreted when you do something like compare. So here is a series of hash comparisons. Let's say that you want to see if this hash is equal to 0. The reason that you would want to do this is because the hash function, this is PHP, I think, the hash function in PHP outputs 0 in the case of an error. So you want to make sure that you handle these errors. You check the output, make sure it's equal to 0, and then do something. Well, it turns out that this value is equal to 0. This value is equal to 0. This value is not equal to 0. Does anyone know why that is? Exactly. So we have the problem is that these values are all essentially, if there's anything that is either 0 or non-numeric at the left side of the string is treated, I think, as the integer 0. And so the comparison just goes ahead. But these are language problems, not API problems. If they didn't cause so many actual difficulties, this would be kind of funny. The last thing I just want to mention quickly is that we really have no good idea of how to do key management. Most cryptographic libraries today say, here is a string. Put that string somewhere. Make sure that string doesn't get swapped. Internally, OpenSSL has some utterly insane code for making sure that keys go into secure areas of RAM. I don't understand how it works. It's very hard for most people to access the APIs and to store keys properly, and there are very few sort of people who have addressed this problem. Keysar tries to do some of this, and they try to make sure that keys are updated and rotated, but it's kind of a difficult thing to deal with. So the last thing I want to point out is that we think it's getting better, but it's not really getting better, because now with the proliferation of JavaScript web apps, there's been a huge demand for crypto on the web, and one of the responses to this has been the W3C crypto API, which is coming out soon. I just want to point out one kind of the reason that I'm so frustrated with this. Here is the list of recommended algorithms. This was an opportunity for us to reimagine crypto kind of from the ground up. And what we're getting is something that recommends a series of recommended algorithms where AES-CBC by itself is one of them. We get RSA PKCS1 v1.5. Now, fortunately, this is just the signature, which is only vulnerable in specific cases, not in others. We also have a number of other algorithms that are better, but we're not being given kind of a high-level choice. The last thing that I kind of want to point out is that I think this is actually Ben's doing. Inside, if you look at the main spec, this is actually a very big improvement over the first draft. In order to keep people from thinking that they're qualified to use this API, The API has been divided into two interfaces, one of which is called subtle crypto. What this says is that essentially you are only allowed to use subtle crypto if you're the kind of person who can handle subtlety, if you know something about this kind of, you know, the details of crypto. However, it's not entirely clear to me that anybody's going to implement anything other than subtle crypto. So basically what the library is doing is saying you should be scared away from this thing. Now, there is a high-level API, and I do hope it is shipped, but I'm not sure that anything other than this will be. I'm not convinced that anything other than the subtle crypto stuff will be put out there, but at least we'll be properly scared away. That is a really weird name. Anyway, I'm talking a lot. If anybody wants to break in, feel free to. The question that I think is much harder to answer is kind of what do we do about this? I've just been giving this laundry list of kind of broken things, but what are we going to do about it? And I think Microsoft has a few ideas. But the question is, what are we going to do to make these things a little bit more secure? Well, one answer is we can try to build tools that give us kind of usage, user and developer resilient cryptography. This is actually not very easy, and it's a question that researchers don't want to get involved with because it's, to many people, it's an engineering problem. It's not a research problem. Let me give you a few examples of people who have done this kind of well. So Dan Bernstein has a library called NACL, which is his efficient, easy-to-use library, his sort of advanced library. Going back to what OpenSSL looks like, this is encryption with an RSA public key. Well, this is the same thing in NACL. Many people have probably seen this. The major difference is that everything is done with strings. There's no need for specialized data structures. Everything can go into one kind of crypto box call. Now, what this does is it takes away the freedom to improperly compose symmetric and asymmetric encryption, to do max wrong. It just says, you want to encrypt something, use this. The downside of this, though, and this is actually becoming a fairly popular library, the downside is that now we have to do whatever Dan Bernstein tells us. Which means that if Dan wants us to use Salsa 20 and Poly 1305, then we have to use that because this library is going to become popular. And I think it is. It's a great library. People should use it. But we should have more libraries that kind of compete with this and give us the same kind of intuitive API without forcing us to choose algorithms. Another area that has, you know, kind of seen this is going back to the W3C API, is separating layers. You know, there are always going to be needs for these kind of backwards compatibility legacy crypto. We should have libraries that give us those underlying algorithms. But at the same time, we should have more crypto boxes. We should give people choices. And this is, I think, what Ben is trying to do with the subtle crypto and with the splitting up of the library. I'd like to see more of that. One of the areas that I think is the most challenging, though, is how do we actually treat this as a research problem? How do we go into code that's already out there? How do we go into libraries and build things that can't be misused properly, or misused or used improperly? One of the areas that people have kind of tried to address this is in domain-specific languages and languages that are kind of designed to make it difficult for you to do things that are insecure. Unfortunately, there are only a few of these things. There's this, Ben actually has this Haskell translator, which I'm not even going to say its name.
It's called Stupid.
Yeah, which I think you need to change that name. But that's kind of a very specific, domain-specific language for translating symmetric crypto descriptions into code. It's not really designed for users. But there's kind of a problem space around building languages where you can do these things securely and then have them analyzed. Another direction people have moved is, for example, Microsoft has a key management service called DKM. There's also a recent paper on building SSL implementations where they can be formally analyzed. Unfortunately, this again is more focused towards engineers who are working in crypto, not at end users. But you could conceive of it going that way one day. The problem is, although it seems very promising to build these kind of tools, developers don't like it. So to give an example, the DKM system, the key management system at Microsoft, was first implemented in F7. It was verified in F7. And then it was completely re-implemented in C#. And that kind of thing happens because nobody wants to maintain an F7 code base. I guess the last thing I'm going to talk about, and I hope that you guys will have some ideas beyond these kind of obvious, you know, techniques, are we should at least have tools that can do analysis of code bases just a little bit better. Probably the most famous recent example is the Stanford work where they were actually statically analyzing code bases to see if certificate validation was being done correctly. Well, that's a relatively simple problem, fortunately, because most of these API calls are straightforward. But there are more complex kind of compositions of things where you could actually see, is somebody encrypting and macking correctly? Is somebody managing keys correctly? Is there a life cycle for the keys? You could build an entire tool set that could go through open source code bases and find the answer to these questions. There is also a set of work that's, again, kind of focused differently, but looking at secure APIs and seeing, are people implementing these incorrectly so that there are ways for me to go and wrap a key and then decrypt that key and pull it out of an HSM. So all of these techniques exist, but very few of them are being applied in kind of practical ways. And so that's all I'm going to say at you today, but I hope that some people here, I know that a few people had ideas on how to address this and how to make it more of a research problem. So if anybody wants to propose anything, feel free.
I was just going to say, I mean, there's this education problem for developers, but also there's an education and community building problem for the research community, right? We have a very strong research community that does theory work in crypto, and a very strong security community, and there's not a very large community of applied cryptographers, at least from my perspective, and I think from the perspective of several other people in the community. So, you know, you point out, like, Dan, he's one of the few guys who does work in this space, but it'd be great to get more people excited and interested in these problems. Shameless plug for Real World Crypto. We've been running this for the last couple of years. People come, a lot of industry interaction. It's been a lot of fun. So,
no, I agree. I think there's a huge community, and I'd like to see more people kind of do this. I would also like to see more of an interaction between just the cryptography community and the security community. I mean, even if we forget about the people who actually use crypto, I would love to see more papers on kind of applying crypto to real security problems in security conferences and maybe vice versa at crypto conferences. So, one thing at a time.
Okay. It's Gary. How do you see the problem being split between the need for new crypto systems that are resilient to improper use and engineering solutions that maybe provide, you know, better function calls that are easy to understand?
So I think that there's room for both. I mean, we've had a lot of work recently, and for example, authenticated encryption schemes that can handle nonce, for example, nonces being improperly generated or even being reused in some cases. There's been some work that kind of takes into account that the user or the developer will make mistakes and tries to minimize the damage that will happen. I think there's a lot of work to be done there. Unfortunately, that work is maybe not as well received by the community, but it's important. But I don't think you should separate this into purely an engineering problem. I think there is really a research problem in terms of how, you know, maybe it's just that researchers have the skill, but how do you take the knowledge that we have and the skills that we have and actually solve fundamental problems, not just build things that look easier to use, although a lot of these examples would be fixed by that. I think that you have to actually kind of treat the problem the same way. Maybe it's a usable security problem. I'm not sure what it is, but there's something out there.
So what would be the ideal outcome from your perspective of the W3C efforts at this point? Would it be simultaneously release the high-level library and rename subtle API to low-level? Would that be good?
I think that the first thing would be to release the high-level API and then to make sure that it's very difficult to ever touch that low-level API. I think that would be the most critical thing. Wouldn't that be great? There's always going to be a need for legacy crypto. So I'm coming from this having very briefly participated in this process in the early days, where the W3C basically said, we are not going to do a high-level API, we are only going to build a low-level API, and legacy applications are our primary motivator. And they still are if you read the spec. So I think there's a huge progress, I'm not complaining about the progress, that now we're moving towards having a high-level and a low-level API. But what I'm concerned about is that, however it's done, there are too many developers who are going to end up picking up that low-level API. I'm not sure how to dissuade them. I'm not sure if we can, you know, give them electroshocks or something every time they touch it, but there's got to be some way to make it much more realistic and usable to use that high-level API than to go anywhere near the low-level one.
But the high-level API is not final yet, right?
Exactly.
But so
none of it is really final yet.
Okay. But if they both came out at the same time...
I think if they both came out at the same time, you would have a subset of people who would go with the high-level API. I think that would be... So I think the question is how do you keep people from going and going near that low-level API? How do you really stress to people that it should be very difficult to use the insecure modes of operation? I think that would be the challenge. Is how do you make it easy to use the secure modes and difficult to use the insecure modes?
What I've noticed is when I teach and when we teach people cryptography, we often start by telling them about primitives like block ciphers, RSA encryption, message authentication codes, hash functions, the low-level building blocks. And I wonder if that's the right way, if that's where we should start. You know, for a long time I've wondered if maybe a better the API to cryptography for most developers would be the notion of a secure channel. Mm-hmm. And if we could give them the notion of a secure channel, would that deal with 80% of their problems? And we probably need some equivalent of that for storage. So I don't know what that would really be, but I'm tempted to say, you know, the notion of like SSL and maybe DTLS or something for secure channel, and maybe if we had a corresponding notion for storage, and if we just stopped teaching people block ciphers, RSA, the basic building blocks, or if we only did that after we first taught them the sort of more high level primitive, do you think that would be a better world, or do you think that people really need the flexibility from composing these basic building blocks?
I think that for most purposes, you would be fine with a secure channel and a secure box. The ability to wrap something up for storage and the ability to send something over a secure channel. Now, there are going to be subtle, you know, cases where you have to deal with the subtle crypto interface, but there are going to be some kind of specialized cases. But I agree, that would be the right way to do it, and to actually make, if you're going to treat this as an education problem, to treat those kind of high-level APIs as part of the, you know, core curriculum of computer science. Now, I'm not going to tell people how they should teach other people, but I think that would be the key.
So let me ask a follow-up question for everyone in the room. Would you like to advocate for those of us who teach security classes to only teach secure channel and secure box? And stop. If people got out of these classes and they weren't taught what AES was, what RSA was, what, you know, all these other basic building blocks, would you be happy with that?
I would be fine with it.
Specific decision not to teach RSA or block ciphers in our core security class because they learn RSA and then they think, oh my god, this is
so easy. I can do this. Look, it's just exponentiation. And instead we have a course that's a core theory course, and it teaches about the nature of randomness and what it means to be indistinguishable from random. And they basically stagger out of that course and say, oh my God, I'm never going to try to change protocol in my life. And I think that is a better level of education for most master's students, frankly. It teaches them mathematics and a little modesty.
Early on in your presentation, you distinguished between the secure APIs and the developer APIs. But one of the things the secure APIs are really meant for doing is to store keys. And I find in my analysis of web apps and of smartphone apps, which is another place where a lot of this crypto stuff is being used to provide military-grade encryption, et cetera, for note-taking apps. I mean, the flaw usually is where you put the keys. If you have the key, okay, we can use a nice API to get the keys, where do you put the keys? And the API for storing these keys securely, which is related, I think it's sort of an important concern. I was wondering whether you thought about that a little.
Well, so I mean, I think that's very important for people. I mean, as somebody who's developing a cryptographic library right now, it's very hard to deal with. What is the right interface for storing keys? Do you store the key for the application developer and then just make them carry around a handle? Can you do it better than they can? Will they be able to take that key to other applications? There are a lot of questions there. And then how do you make your system compatible with hardware security modules and so on? But that's as far as the secure APIs, how to do it better than what's out there, that's a really hard question. I don't have many answers to that. Maybe Ben does.
So I don't agree with David's suggestion about teaching only secure channel for a couple of reasons. One, I'm trying to teach people to think about things, not train them in here's the magic spell you use. They have to understand underlying concepts. Yes, you need really big, bright warnings. Do not roll your own. You will get it wrong. You know, this is something even trained professionals seem to get wrong with great regularity. But you have to understand what's going on under the hood, certainly at the university level, even at the undergraduate level. I would also add that one of the reasons for the complexity of many of these crypto APIs, and I agree that many of them are quite awful. I've got a few more that I could add to your list. My favorite was the Kerberos interface, which checked the parity bits, and if it didn't have the right parity, it would encrypt with a key of all zeros. Is because there are too many needs that are a little bit different. People are inventing their own very often because the standard one doesn't do the right thing. And you have to know a little bit more. I wish there were just a simple API that I could do, but it's not that simple in too many cases. We're in a lot better shape right now that very often we can say at the protocol level, use TLS. But then you get to go worry about what are the proper, what should the certificate look like and who should certify it and what should the domain name be and so on. And different, we know what it should or perhaps shouldn't be for the web, but for lots of other applications of TLS, it's not necessarily that simple. You need a more powerful API to express these variants. So API is a difficult problem, but I don't know that it can be quite as simple as you and I would like.
So I think that the right analogy here is the first time you ever wrote a file, did you have any notion of inodes and the structure of the file system underneath it? I mean,
they didn't exist the first time I wrote.
So I think that the way we should be treating, at least for novice developers, the way we should be treating crypto is the same way we treat files. They should be black boxes. We should basically deal with them as a simple API. Obviously, there are always going to be applications where you really need to understand that underlying file system. I'm not saying take that away, but we should be clear that you should never try to develop your own file system until you really know what you're doing.
So I want to agree with Steve, so I write the Keymaster.
Yeah,
I write Keymaster, which is the internal version of KeyXR at Google. And one of the really frustrating things was the plan there was to do exactly what people keep talking about, only provide safe APIs. And then it turned out instantly that people had requirements that were contradictory on what safe was. So a classic example is you want to encrypt something. There's two really obvious motivations for encrypting something. One is the usual one, your crypto box thing. The other is because you want to use it as a key in a database that you don't want to reveal what that key actually is. And so for that, you need deterministic encryption, which is exactly the wrong thing to do for the other case. Another thing we kept running into is people had length constraints, so you had to truncate your max and stuff like that. It just turned out that we ended up with a huge API that was only safe if correctly used, even though it was very high level, and we controlled all the crypto. Plus, it turned out to be really hard to audit. We are working on, we're thinking about a version 2 now. So I actually think that possibly the right way to do this is to not try and restrict access to the low-level APIs, but make it easy to compose them in good ways and to build things as pipelines. It's actually, I've been playing with this a bit, is to build things as pipelines rather than giving you access to the raw bits after each stage. And make it possible to assert things about pipelines, such as this pipeline gives me authenticated encryption. And make it difficult to pull the bits out of the middles of pipelines. So you have to put stuff in and get it out in approved ways, and in between the pipeline has to be constructed correctly. And use the same pipeline for both ends as well. That's my idea. Don't know if I can make it work, but I'm trying.
It's a good idea.
Yeah, so I agree with that. Better APIs will help, but I think education, there's things that you cannot put into the API that people need to know. And one of the class of errors that I see that I try to teach about is the fact that you can't just pick a crypto in a blind fashion if you're also building a coding of your data that you're trying to encrypt or store or whatever. So I tend to agree a little bit with Steven that they need to understand just enough of the crypto so that they can understand that if I encrypt a key or if I encrypt a letter between A and Z using RSA, it's not going to be secure unless I've got the proper padding. So it's just enough that they understand the relationship between coding and crypto and the interdependency. And that needs to be taught. And there's no API that's going to substitute for that.
So my concern is that I don't think that's going to be taught. I think that some 50% of the people who are going to be actively developing these systems and putting them into deployment are just never going to be exposed to that. I mean, that's a very obvious thing to all of us. It's not obvious to somebody whose primary job is software development. So I think that we need to build tools that can be resilient to that 50%. I'm just not sure how to do it, but I think that as laudable a goal as that would be, I don't think it's achievable.
I think it's easier as a society. It's a political social problem. I think it's easier to make it mandatory for all software engineers to have a minimal security training that includes that than it is to build the perfect API that is going to be able to suit all, not only crypto needs, but coding needs.
So I don't think you can build a perfect API that will suit all needs. But what I do think is that
you're... And endogenous find them.
what I do think is that you're going to have a certain number of people who only touch crypto on occasion. And they are not going to feel that they have to know anything about crypto or security. They are doing one operation in their entire career, and that's something that's going to be critical for a lot of people, a lot of users, but they are not going to invest in develop and understanding crypto. So you need an API for those people. And you need a way to make sure that API is sort of prime in what they use and not that they're going to move to another API. I keep saying this, but that's my feeling.
Just one last span in the works there. One of the solutions that is being talked about in Canada and now in Europe is the fact that certain things that you do that are critical in software engineering would require certification, would require it only being allowed to do by certain people that have been trained properly. That's another part of the solution, I think.
How many people think that's going to be? I'm not criticizing that. I'm just curious. How many people here raising your hand do you think that's going to happen in the near future in the U.S. at least? In the world?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, I'm just curious. Skeptical.
I don't think it will. I mean, it may happen at the corporate level.
Yeah.
But how many corporations have developed things for the App Store that is in the hands of 90% of the people that are out there? Unless you're going to require everybody who writes an app that touches, you know, any sort of encryption, that they have to go through a few people to do that, you're fighting a battle there that just isn't going to, I mean, it isn't going to work. In a corporate environment, yes, you know, that yes, you have to do this for a bank or for a hospital or for something like that, you're fine, because you do have some power, you do have some leverage. But that's commodity software for the masses. That's not going to make it.
We have someone.
I worked for medicine 100 years ago. 100 years ago, anybody was in medicine. It's not the case anymore. You might take 100 years.
We have someone in the back. I want to make sure they don't.
To the usage of Kezar, we're actually trying to do that internally in our organization. I do think that secure APIs are the way to go because, so for example, as a security engineer, the basics that you need to understand to, you know, build a platform that your developers can directly use and be like, okay, that's all I have to do. This is a credential and I need to store it securely. And as long as I'm told that this is the function call I'm making and that should be it, I think that should work. So we're not at the phase where we have actually rolled it out to our developers, but I do think that works because we have a management system between what Kezar provides you and, you know, what the developer needs to use. So as long as you have that, all your developer has to do is they go to this interface and say, this is my secret value that I need to store. You take care of how you're storing it. And in the background, I, as a security engineer, use Kezar to make sure that that's being done correctly. And the developer just needs to go in and put that secret value and get back, you know, whatever he needs to get. And I do think that secure API should be the way to go. And we actually haven't run into challenges yet because we haven't rolled it out yet, but maybe we'll run into roadblocks and realize, like, you know, what the problem is with that. I would love to talk to you about that, actually.
Okay. Yeah, I'm curious to hear what that conversation sounds like.